All right, we're back again. If you are returning from previous live episodes or pre-recorded on your Spotify, Apple Music, welcome back. If this is your first time, I'm really glad you're here. My name is Corinne. I'm a speech language pathologist. All I think about is gestalt processing, like all I think about. And I started this podcast because I wanted to play a place to interview people who also care about GLPs, talk about some of the research. And just keep building conversations around this area in our field that more and more people are taking interest in. A big topic that comes up a lot, again and again, and sometimes with a lot of contention and emotion, is ABA. What is our relationship as speech language pathologists, as parents, anyone else listening in your role? What is our relationship with this other field that plays a really big role in the lives of GLPs and autistic children and young adults? And what can conversations look like that feel, productive instead of contentious? And so I was really excited to bring on someone who has become a friend. This is Rachel Peters, MS, BCBA, LBA. Rachel and I connected over our passion for working with GLPs from different directions, from different disciplines. And I wanted to interview Rachel about how she approaches work with GLPs, how she pulls from her field, the modifications, the adjustments, and the flexibility that she's brought into this work, as well as start to talk about what are some of the overlaps between our fields. What are we speaking about, but just on different terms? And how can our fields move forward together? Because neither of our fields are going away, and we both care about these kids that we work with. So, Rachel Peters, it has been a board-certified behavior analyst since 2020, has been working in the field since 2017. She's implemented ABA services in a variety of environments, including foster homes, residential facilities, a juvenile justice facility, and more recently in homes in Alabama, Georgia, and Colorado. Her clinical areas of interest include early intervention, language acquisition, caregiver consultation, fieldwork supervision, ACT, and incorporating values-based programming in all aspects of clinical service. So, Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Corinne. I'm so excited to be here. A little nervous, because, like you said, this can be a contentious conversation. But I remember one of the first things you had said to me was like, "You sound friend-shaped," and I was like, "You know what? You're correct. Let's be friends."
Well, there's so much in the way you communicate because we connected over social media, which is where so much of the GLP discourse is happening. And I really enjoyed the way you talked about these kids that I cared about and the ideas behind it. I was really drawn to that, and we've had some cool conversations. And I was like, let's bring this bigger than just our direct messages.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm super stoked to be here. So a little bit about me. I've been at BCBA now for a little over 5 years. I started as a registered behavior technician, which is kind of like the entry level position, at a point in my life where I was kind of missing some direction. I went back to school to finish my bachelor's, had a class about autism, and I was like, "Ooh, this job sounds really interesting. I feel like I could connect with that." And I did. Thought I would be an RBT forever, but then I was like, "I want to do more." So I went to grad school, moved from California to Alabama, which was enlightening in and of itself. Went to grad school, passed the exam, and then I changed everything about how I learned. About what I learned. I love this social media space. It can be toxic, but the connections that I've built from social media, connections with you, connections with other SLPs, other BCBAs, other folks in the field, other advocates, I wouldn't be where I am today without social media. And that's kind of where I got started learning about Gestalt language processing. We don't talk about language acquisition in grad school or as BCBAs, even as RBTs, other than just contingency management. Like, here's my instruction, here's the response, here's what I'm doing as a result to teach this language. So I don't know a lot about how brain processes work. I'm fascinated by that. Started to see some posts about echolalia and how it can be functional language. The reason it hit home for me is because of my nephew, who is young. He's autistic, and before he had developed more language, he was doing a lot of these things that I was seeing in these posts: the intonation, the rich intonation, the songs, the books, like memorizing those as those scripts. And I was like, "There's something here. There's something magical here." We're taught in grad school, for the most part, that echolalia is a behavior to reduce, and that's never sat right with me. And then starting to kind of explore this possibility just made me shift my practices a little bit. Not, I don't have access to SLP literature. I have access to ABA literature. We don't talk about this kind of stuff. But what I do know is how to change my behavior to then shape different responses. And that's all I did. And for me, in my clinical practice, it's been helpful with the presumed Gestalt language processors that I've worked with. So that's where I'm at. That's where this connection kind of happened. What else to say? I don't know.
Well, that's where I come in. All right. So I want to hear about, like, think about right now. So that's where you've come from. When you think about the right now of working with Gestalt processors, what can that look like? Is there maybe like a case example that illustrates how you interact with these kids or just general principles of how you've
Yeah.
shifted?
So one of the things that we're taught, we use, our SD, our discriminative stimulus. And I'm going to throw out some words, but I'm going to explain them because I don't want to come across as someone who's just using these words to talk above people's heads. That's not how we come together and collaborate. So my instruction, what color is this? Then I might use a prompt and say red. And then perhaps a client might just say the color red. And I would say, yay, good job. Great. Now, when I have a presumed Gestalt language processor, if I give that prompt of say red, I'm going to get say red. They don't teach us how to handle that when we're in grad school. So we would get stuck a lot. If I have a client who is engaging in echolalia, I'm going to get stuck with the say red, whatever that might be. So all I did is shift the way that I present that opportunity. Wow, it's red. And now in response, I might get, wow, it's red. Yeah, it is red. That's so awesome. And then carry on from there. I'll incorporate that into play. I'll incorporate that into self-advocacy. If I notice, I'm going to give an example of my nephew. One of the things that he would say is, are you stuck? And I don't know where he got it from, but he would say that a lot, and he would be in a position where it looked like he needed help. So I was hanging out with him one day. He's trying to put together these car tracks. He put them together, take it apart, and then he would bring it to me and say, are you stuck? And I was like, oh, it looks like you need help. And then I just started modeling put together, or I need help. Gave him a couple of different options. And then he started coming back to me with put together, put together. And every time he asked me to put it together, you bet I'm putting it together. So that is kind of how I've shifted my practice, just observing, seeing the context in which this script is being used, shifting my behavior to maybe give that model, maybe a door's stuck, I need help. Maybe a toy is stuck, I need help. Or I'm not ready, or no, not right now. Those are some of my favorite things to model, is those self-advocacy pieces, not just, cool, the pen's red. What do I care if you can't advocate for yourself? So that's kind of how I've shifted my practice is instead of overusing prompts, I'm modeling and I'm not necessarily expecting something in return. If I get it, cool, great. If not, we're going to carry on.
Yeah, you're speaking to a lot of like the important early shifts that people talk about when we're like talking to parents about GLP, SLPs who might be new to these ideas and these recommendations, and of course, other people from other fields, where we also come from like a pretty quiz heavy language culture with kids. Even if it's not like quizzing about colors or shapes, it's, are you having fun? Are you playing with that?
Yes.
You like it?
Yeah.
And it's when I'm working with late talkers, I'm like, how do you expect, respectfully and gently, how do you expect your late talker to answer a question they don't have the answer to, right?
Right.
So it's that flip away from the quizzing and questioning, which I wonder is like, is that rooted in like anxiety for some people interacting with kids? It's like, I don't know how to, I'm not sure how to talk to this kid, but asking a question that feels like the right adult thing to do.
Yeah.
I saw you react to that. Do you have anything, something to
Yeah.
say? Okay.
Yeah. I would bet that there's an anxiety piece there. I supervise a lot of RBTs. And our sessions are generally longer than an SLP session, than a speech therapy session. So we're with them for a long period of time. And I feel like oftentimes RBTs or even BCBAs want to just like opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. I gotta keep going. But like there's beauty in the silence too. Like there's opportunities, but sometimes I think about like if I'm just continuing to ask questions, I'm placing a demand. Yeah, I'm asking a question, but I am placing a demand for you to answer that question. And again, like you said, they might not have the language to answer that question. So like
Totally.
I'm a yapper. I love to yap. I love to play, but I've really had to, especially with my GLP learners, I've really had to like pump the brakes and
Yeah.
enjoy that silence. Just observe and see where the language is taking us.
Yeah. And the silence is really critical. Like thinking, because I love the like the psychoacoustic side of it, or just the sensory. We often think about like sensory processing as like the proprioceptive input, or like how we can use sensory processing to like move to the next level. When I'm thinking about just like how are we processing the sensation of noise, of speech, of music, of language, not of language, of speech. Pardon me, but the silence plays such an important role in parsing out word from word, sentence from sentence, communicate, like spoken act from spoken act. Without that silence, we're losing a lot of really important information. Silence provides a lot of important information. It also gives time for that kid to process,
Yeah.
to encode, and I use the word map a lot. If you're modeling spoken language, AAC, sign, you're trying to map meaning onto the moment. But if you're just like more and more and more and more, there, it's harder to know like what's mapping to what.
Yeah.
There aren't any breaks. I think I love analogies so much. I explain it. I'm always trying to tailor an analogy to who I'm talking to.
Oh my God.
And like, what are their interests? Like, what do they care about? So like, if we've got a dad who's an athlete, I'm going to talk about running. If we've got a mom who's an artist. So I had a mom who's an artist. And I was like, okay, imagine you go into a museum and every square inch of the wall is covered in art. And she was like, you could see her body react. And I
Yeah.
was like, okay, that's if you don't stop talking to a kid for an hour. Now you go into a room in a museum and there's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen and it's framed and there's lots of empty space around it. How are you going to feel? She's like, I'm going to focus on it and take time and like really look at it. And I was like, exactly. The empty space around that painting is the silence. It makes the language and the words stand out so you can pay more attention, appreciate it, and not be distracted by everything else around it.
That's beautiful. That's quite the analogy. And I also live in this space of analogies too. When I talk about acceptance and commitment therapy slash training, it's very values driven. It's very much based in analogies. Constantly I'm looking for what do my clients value? What is important to them? So I Like I mentioned in my bio, I'm bringing that into each session with each learner, with each parent too, because what's valuable for the parent might not necessarily line up with what's valuable for that learner.
Absolutely. Speaking of like tailoring how we teach and how we communicate things to others, thinking back to, ABA and SLP, there's one thing that I wanted to talk about, which comes up often. So one of the first things I learned from a BCBA back when I first started an early intervention, she would help me walk through like the four functions of behavior. And at that time, I found it really helpful. Parents like connected with it because it felt so structured. But since then, I've like, there's parts of it where I pause or I'm like, that doesn't feel like the whole picture. And then you brought up the four principles of behavior. So can you, let's talk about those because a lot of our
Yeah.
listeners have probably heard about the four functions,
Yeah.
perhaps not the four principles.
Right. So the four functions are the reasons why we do things. And okay, great. It breaks it down. It is really structured. I learned about them in grad school. I still know about them and I still use them essentially to kind of help format my programming, but I go beyond that a little bit. I could go on and on about the six core yearnings, which go a little bit deeper than just the four functions of behavior, which is like,
Four yearnings. Oh my
yeah,
gosh.
go ahead and look that one up.
I'm looking it up. It just
Yeah.
reminds me of like millennial women being like, oh, yearning never ends.
Yeah,
Okay.
no, it's a lot deeper than just like I want access to this thing, or why I want to escape this thing, or I want attention, or like there's a sensory function. Those are our four main functions: sensory, attention, tangible, and escape.
Yeah.
Cool, great.
I am going to read out the yearnings because I know our listeners, someone's going to jump in and be like, what are they?
Yes.
So, six core yearnings, and this is the hexagon model of
Is
psychological.
the Hexaflex. Yeah.
I
Yes.
love
This
this.
is
Okay.
the core component of psychological flexibility and acceptance and commitment therapy.
This is, yeah, the more I learn about ACT, like, I'm like, okay, this is where I feel like we can meet in the middle. So, okay.
Yes.
Yearning for belonging, yearning for coherence, yearning for orientation, yearning for feeling. Whew, I love these. Yearning for
Yeah.
self-directed meaning. Oh man. Yearning for competence. Okay, this is our second episode. So
Yeah.
come back to that.
Well, yeah, we'll come back to that. We'll circle back because those go deeper than just the four functions. And we as humans are complex. So just labeling a behavior with one particular function is not going to cut it. It's just not. It might be helpful on a surface level, but it's only going to go so far. And that's part of what I do is constantly assessing, is this function changing? Is the core yearning changing? And we bring a lot of that into like some trauma-informed care, which is why I love where I'm at right now, because I get to do this. I get to incorporate ACT. I get to incorporate trauma-informed care, and go deeper than just here's what I learned in grad school, and I'm not going to progress any further than that. The four principles of behavior are principles of reinforcement and punishment. So there's positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, and negative punishment. And I have a little infographic pulled up. Did I lose it? I didn't. Okay, so positive reinforcement we think of as a reward, right? If I give this instruction, I get this response, it was a correct response, boom, we get a reward. Whatever that might be, a Skittle, an M&M. I don't love that. It could be high quality praise. It could be, oh my gosh, you ask me to quack like a duck. Cool, I'm about to quack like a duck. Negative reinforcement is relief from something. So kind of like we talked about a little bit earlier, the alarm goes off. I need to shut that off. Cool. Now I have relief from that obnoxious sound. Positive punishment is the application of a punishment. It could be, to be harsh and to think about like some of the current status of my own field. It's the application of a shock. I know it. I'm sure y'all know it. There are places that still operate in that manner. It can also be corrective feedback. It can be, oh, nope, that's A, not B. Right? All I'm trying to do is shape the correct response. How I do that is applied in a lot of different ways,
Yeah, there's so many
obviously.
ways. Yeah.
Negative punishment is like a penalty. So I lose points. I am put in timeout because I stole my friend's juice box. So I'm losing an opportunity to access reinforcing things. I'm losing points because the kid next to me won't stop talking and now we don't get recess, something like that.
Yeah.
So those are our four principles, and those are the things that I'm operating under when I develop my programming. My programming is geared towards positive reinforcement, right? With a little bit of that corrective feedback, depending on the learner that I'm working with. Corrective feedback might not be for everybody, and that's okay. But high importance is that positive reinforcement.
Yeah. And it's like, I think it's when we think about the types of punishment that really stand out that are horrifying, like unquestionably terrible, those we attack. And the word punishment is like, it's a harsh word, right? But think about like, what are the other things that fall under that, like in a more clinical way, like what else
Right.
falls under the, and that's what kept coming up as I was preparing for this episode is there are a lot of things that we speak about with different terms. And I think we'll probably get to that in this episode, even if it's just kind of a foundational way. But there are a lot of things when we step back and really think about what certain terms mean that we do as well. We just call it different things. Or we approach it in different ways, especially because of everything you're talking about, these are all just kind of like human principles, right? All day today, my entire Tuesday, I was experiencing positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, and negative punishment, even in just subtle ways while I'm driving. I mean, think about all the behaviors in driving. I'm experiencing all of those, but I think it's really painful for people to see it like, when it's with kids who are vulnerable in ways that just are like, how are we still doing this in 2025?
Exactly. And I don't think the field of behavior analysis has done a very good job of disconnecting that negative connotation, especially with positive punishment, because I'll use positive punishment with my supervisees.
Yep.
Like, hey, I want to know what this term means, and you got it wrong. So I'm going to correct you and tell you what it is. And then I'm going to come back. I'm going to ask you again, and I'm going to hope that your behavior has changed. That's all. And really, we don't know if something is reinforcing or punishing until we see that behavior change. People will talk all the time about like, oh, a reinforcer, a reward. I don't know if it's truly a reinforcer unless I see that behavior increase. I don't know if it's truly a punisher unless I see that behavior decrease. Like for myself, for example, you'd think in my 30 plus years of life, I have burned my tongue enough times to know to wait before I eat my food because sometimes it's a little too hot. At least once a month.
No, it I did that 3 hours ago.
Just taste buds gone for a week. It's fine. I have not learned. My behavior has not changed.
And so, like for that example, like what could, if you were gonna do that to yourself, what would you shift for the future? Or is it not even motivating enough? Because the food, that first bite
God.
is motivating.
The food is what's the motivator. So I will not be changing my behavior. And it doesn't happen frequently enough that it bothers me enough.
True.
So
Okay. Yeah, I think with another one that comes up a lot is like extrinsic motivation versus intrinsic motivation, and like related rewards versus unrelated rewards. So we talk about like the locus of motivation. And a lot of people talk about things like Skittles or Cheetos, like that being unrelated to the skill you're trying to help develop. Tell me about your relationship with like motivators
Yeah.
externally.
One, it's going to be like, I need to get to know this kid. Point blank, period. I could bring Skittles. What if they hate Skittles? Then, exactly, like that's not going to be motivating enough to change. And I'm just throwing dry spaghetti at the wall. I need to know what this kid finds valuable. I need to know what their interests are so I can incorporate that into learning opportunities. So, for example, K-pop Demon Hunters, big deal right now. Really big deal right now.
How dare you bring that up when I'm trying to work right now?
I'm so sorry.
How dare you? Okay,
Okay,
sorry.
I'm gonna let you in on a secret. I haven't watched it yet because I've been busy with school.
Okay, all right.
This weekend, I'll watch it.
I'm
Don't
fine.
judge me.
Dare you?
But I've got a couple clients who are very into K-pop Demon Hunters right now. You best believe that I'm gonna be pulling up K-pop Demon Hunter songs. We're gonna be incorporate, like, you wanna play some imaginative play and we can work on some self-advocacy requests? Cool. What character am I gonna be? I may not know her, but you let me know. So whatever that interest is, and our interests change. We're human. Our interests are going to shift over time. In our field, we do preference assessments. We do reinforcer assessments, which are cool. I love seeing the stats behind them. I've also applied to do a talk for RBTs at a conference, showing them how to do it because it's fun. I feel like, it's a good time. And it's important to know where these things came from and how they can help sort of shift our practices. But I could do a preference assessment at an initial intake. It'll give me a hierarchy of preference. Cool, great. The next time I see that kid, that could be different.
I feel like especially with, not especially with, but I see that with Gestalt processors where I, 'cause I, when I'm thinking about like positive reinforcement or like that sense of reward, I'm often working through this lens of like what can be a really immersive, rewarding experience. Like immerse, like how my session can be this immersion in a lot of like joy and connection and feeling really good about the back and forth signaling and symbols. And so I'll try and create sessions where we're like in the special interest, kind of like, K-pop
Yes.
Demon Hunters. Are we like in this movie right now? So that the whole container, the immersion feels rewarding to different degrees. But what's so interesting is like a lot of GLPs I've worked with, week to week, it's a new special interest. So I have gone hard all weekend learning Peppa Pig quotes. No, it's Bluey week.
Yeah.
So, but being able to be like nimble with that,
Yeah.
I think that could be something that takes getting used to as well when you think about what's really rewarding and motivating for the kid in
Right.
front of me.
And I think that's where, at least for me, that psychological flexibility comes in. Like, okay, great. I've got this whole plan laid out for this session. I have watched K-pop Demon Hunters. I know the dance moves. I know the songs. And then now we're on to Batman. All right, cool. Got to shift. Excellent.
And even when I'm thinking about a lot of like thinking about GLPs who are really like embodying that stage one profile, not just stage one, but sometimes if someone else gets too close to that very special thing or tries to manipulate it, change it, or use it as carrot stick, it's real, it's like it seems almost painful for them, where it's like you're trying to take this thing I love and I care about and transform it into like a carrot stick relationship. And I've seen kids like give up a special interest if it's been harnessed
Yeah.
for a different reason, which can be hard to
Like,
see.
oh, you can't have this until we do this.
Yes,
And I
carrot.
know that's a lot of the criticisms that get lobbied at our field because of that carrot stick relationship. Because, oh, I found your special interest. Cool. I'm gonna hold this. I'm gonna hang on to it until I get the response that I want. Instead of, like you're saying, I'm going to immerse myself in there with you authentically, not just because I said so. I'm going to do this authentically. Yeah. That's where we get a lot of pushback.
Totally. And I think like We hear like carrot stick is one. There's another phrase I was thinking about, another analogy. It might hit me. But we had someone in the comments say, and I apologize, I haven't been keeping up well with the comments today because I'm immersed in this rewarding experience. But someone said, I've seen that happen with foods and feeding therapy as well. And so it, yeah, like taking something back, that like taking a lot of power over what brings that child a lot of joy. It's enacting a lot of control, and you might lose that thing that brought them a lot of happiness. And I just feel like the impact on trust could
Yeah.
be really, really
If
harmful.
you don't have trust, you have nothing. You have absolutely nothing. If you don't authentically take time to get to know this child and what they're interested in, you won't develop trust and you will have nothing and you won't have a relationship that's based on back and forth, shared joy, shared interests, shared anything. And when I think about where I run into problems, it's like, okay, you're placing a lot of demands. Have you pumped the brakes and just existed, coexisted? Yeah, that trust is such an important piece, especially if I'm thinking about from a trauma-informed lens, who, let's face it, a lot of children on the spectrum, a lot of the kids that we work with have probably undergone some form of trauma at some point in their life at some level. And I think about that. We talk about this a lot with their parents as well, that they're, you know, they could potentially be in this constant state of fight or flight. So I have to recognize that and I have to lay that groundwork for trust. And again, authentically getting to know what this kid is interested in, not so that I can grab it and manipulate it, but so that we can connect. Because if we have no connection, we will have nothing else.
Yeah, they're thinking about that, yeah, that baseline of does this kid feel as much trust as possible? It's never like forever, right? Trust me can fluctuate even within the hour I'm with a kid, depending on how I behave,
Yep.
and environmental factors. But if we really zoom out, we think about autism. I think we can get so like in it with like the nitty-gritty of behavior and even like certain communicative acts or the grammar. I love grammar, but we can get so dialed in there. And zoom out and think about all the other comorbidities and things that we need to think about. It's like people who talk about like, oh, they're just being stubborn, or they're just being this, they're just being that. And zooming out and thinking about the amount of autistic kids who have visual challenges, whose visual motor systems are mistiming. And so can they even see you coming from the peripheral? If you coming around the periphery scares them, little things like that. Or if they're not actually processing the relationship of phonemes to syllables in the way that you think they are, like the speech signal is different. The speech signal might be overwhelming to them. So it's just this like big zoom out of thinking about what are all of these elements that are helping this kid feel safe or unsafe, regardless of whether we think that they should feel safe or unsafe.
Right.
Their biological experience of that, their social experience of safety might be radically different than what we think it should be.
Yes, exactly. And like that is something I have to consider too. Behavior is more than what just happens in this moment. It is an entire learning history that I may or may not know. If I've done my job in this intake assessment and, you know, really dove into, okay, grammar, I don't know. Divin. If I've divin into it, then, you know, I will have an understanding of where this child is coming from and what, like, okay, maybe their past history with other therapies, maybe their family history, like their school history, all of these different things, all of these ways that they've interacted with the environment have shaped who they are right now. And in this moment, this behavior is the response that has worked, that has helped them survive.
These developed for a reason. Let's think about why. And then is there a more adaptive route so that their life, because I this phrase of like, what can we do to make their life happier, healthier, easier, and safer? That kid is doing the best they can with how their environment and their interactions shaped them to this day. They are not an island.
One of the things that we harp on a lot is that this part of it's kind of part of this like treatment package called skills-based training. But the first component before you start to try anything is this child happy, relaxed, and engaged? Are they engaged with you or are they engaged with something else and they want nothing to do with you? Are they happy? Are they showing indices of happiness? Which, whatever that may look like for each individual, are they relaxed? Are they showing indices of like being relaxed and comfortable? And that is going to look different. So in each of my treatment plans for each of my clients, I have a description of what that looks like for this client. Instead of like happy, relaxed, and engaged, it's going to be a smile on their face, and no, it's going to be different for everybody. But before I even think about placing any kind of demand, I need to make sure that they're happy, relaxed, and engaged. What do I need to do to my behavior to get to that point?
I coach other SLPs a lot. I really enjoy the coaching and supervision process. It sounds like it's, you enjoy it too.
I
I love
do.
it because I love motivational interviewing. I love like reflexive questioning, but when I get a question like I'm doing all the things, but I can't get this kid to talk, that phrasing catches
Can't
me,
get him to do this.
right? And I'm like, I'll ask, and I'm like, I mean this with love, but does that child actually like you? And I'm not saying that like you have to like everyone that teaches you things. I didn't like a lot of my best teachers and professors, but we're talking about a very early developmental period where perception of safety is so important, right? Those early years of life, what are they learning about relationships with others? Like, does your client actually like being around you? Perhaps are they going deeper into their attention tunnel to their toys because whatever you're doing is stressing them out a little bit? Are they retreating or being pretty adaptive to make themselves feel safer by tuning you out more and more? These questions of like, yeah, what am I doing without even realizing it that could be impacting this relationship and their readiness to take in information?
Not a lot of people are ready for it to question themselves in that way. What am I doing? I go back to one of my first jobs as a CPA. I was working in a residential home, and we had students of varying disabilities with varying degrees of severity of behavior. We had disabled children, and we had also kids who had gone through the foster system who struggled with trauma, which I don't love that like there wasn't a trauma-informed lens there. That never really sat right. But whenever there was some sort of behavior that happened to staff, I'm like, well, what'd you do to deserve it?
Oh my God.
Maybe I didn't say that to
Where
the
did it
staff, but I
go?
thought about it. I was like, okay, like if I can go an 8-hour shift and like not get hit, and I can have a conversation with a kid, if I have a kid who elopes out of the building and is ready to hit people and has injured people, and I can follow behind him and say, hey, when you're ready to talk, I'm just right here, just keeping an eye on you for safety. And 2 minutes later, he says, I'm ready to talk. What am I doing differently than the rest of the staff who are in this power position and use that to try and control? I'm not trying to control, I'm trying to keep safe. And I'm trying to establish that boundary of safety. I'm trying to establish that connection and be like, hey, I'm here to listen when you're ready to talk about it. Instead of, let me round the troops and get some physical management here. That's not helpful. That's not teaching you anything. That's teaching you that us adults are unsafe. So, that's a big important factor for me.
Yeah, I'm trying to integrate and synthesize all of that because I thought I had a question like pop into my head about like I'm not even sure what trail to follow with that because that's such a huge topic when it comes to like physicality and injury, like self-injury other like injury towards others that I don't feel as qualified to talk about because I work with like really little ones. But thinking about like where that all starts, right? If a child has a lot of early experiences where like their ability to express what their body needs to externalize is like tamped down or extinguished, like stimming. Stimming serves a really important self-regulatory, I know, you know, a really important self-regulatory purpose. It's a way of trying to get back to homeostasis, to get back to baseline. I think about like videos when people, I follow this Instagram account called Only Friends Reuniting, and it's videos of friends surprising other friends in like the airport. And when they see each other, they more often than not start flapping their hands, shaking. Ah! When they do that as neurotypical, beautiful 20, you know, women in their 20s, we're like, oh my God, I'm crying. It's so beautiful. But if an autistic toddler does that, it's whoa, we should, you know, we should probably get rid of
That's weird. We should stop that.
But our bodies do these things to help us process and get emotions out, right? You've got your fidget right now in your hands. I am tapping my foot on everything down here. And so there's these methods, but some are just really socially acceptable. Some aren't. But then there's also the ones where to externalize anger, frustration, confusion, that kid is going to use the path of least resistance, right? Or the way that, think about when you tense your arm and then you release and hit, there's a lot of energy expelled. It's pretty effective. What else can get them there? What else can we help a kid realize can either symbolically through language is a powerful way to do it, but we can get that release out to help them come back to baseline. And cornering a kid, holding them down, and trying
That
showing
helpful.
those patterns early, it's just I'm gonna think about.
I could get on another soapbox about
I feel
that.
like I read your mind of where it could go. Mine's going there too, but not today.
That's a whole other topic.
I know. I see your eyes getting glassy. There, and a lot of people, I'm sure people listening know where we would go with that. But okay. Ooh, I want to pull back to, I'm looking at like what the outcomes of this episode need to be. Let's briefly touch on, because I feel like there can be such a divide, right? There are some SLPs who blanket like won't work with ABA, tell their clients not to work or bring their kid to ABA. I think probably on your side. I even read some things. There were some, I have to find the exact source of it, but ABA professionals or leaders saying like there's no need for OT and SLP because we got this. So I think on both sides there's, you know, interesting takes on that. But why is it important? I said early in the beginning, like neither of our fields are going away, right? So why is it so important that people like you and me are trying to meet in the middle to talk about GLPs?
What I have found, the longer that I'm out of grad school and now I'm back in graduate school, the longer that I'm in school, the longer that I'm doing this, the less I feel like I know.
Oh my
Especially
God.
going to my first IEP meeting and sitting around the table with people with masters in education who are specialists in special education, SLPs, OTs. I'm just like, y'all know so much. So, coming from me personally, I feel it's important that we keep an open mind instead of being inside this box of like what we know. I constantly am seeking out more information. It's the reason why I'm not going back for a PhD in ABA. I don't want to be stuck in this box. I want to know more. I want to know how to help my learners learn best, how to best support them. And if that means I'm lucky where I'm in a spot that I can co-treat with other specialists, and I love those moments because I'm like, okay, why are you doing this? Show me, is there anything you want us to do in our longer sessions? And not why are you doing this as like an accusatory way, but like tell me why this is what we're teaching and how you're teaching it, because I want to know. I don't want to do it wrong. I don't want to model it incorrectly. So speaking personally for me and most people that I associate with, we want to learn from you because I don't got this. I think it's really arrogant if BCBAs are coming around and saying, like, oh, I can teach language. I can to an extent. I can teach some things, but I do not have the depth and breadth of knowledge that you guys have when it comes to so many of these other things. So I have to lean on you. How can I do this better? Show me what has been working for you. And in that same regard, I hope that other folks come to me and ask the same questions. And to anyone who is listening, tuning in, who has had an experience where they've had a BCBA that is like, I've got this, I'm very sorry. I hate that that's been your experience. I hate that there's people out there that shut out ABA entirely, because I think there's magic when we work together. We all have the same outcome in mind, right? A greater quality of life for the learners and their families that we serve. So when we shut each other out, we are missing an opportunity to increase quality of life for those that we serve. That's my little soapbox about that.
When I think about collaboration, the first thing that comes to mind when I touched on it is like getting on the same page about what are we talking about? What terms do we each use? And like, are we talking about the same things or different things? When you think about like the research world, like operationalizing what we're talking about, a big pushback to GLP framework is like, okay, can you operationalize these things so we all know what we're talking about? Because ideas in the GLP space, there are other terms for those ideas in other places and other approaches. So with ABA coming together and be like, okay, you're saying this. I'd approach it like, are we talking about the same thing? I found that to be really helpful. And someone in the chat also asked, can you give us an example of how SLPs and BCBAs interact within a co-treat session? I'm thinking back to my when I worked in an inclusion school back in DC, and what I did that felt really helpful that I've tried to pull in is this idea of like calling someone in instead of being like, this is me, this is you. It's like, hey, can I invite you into what I'm doing? I asked an RBT who did things I did not agree with. And there was that feeling of tension, but I was like, I'm going to call you in just to try and have a relationship. I was like, let's give her a name. Let's call her Gertrude. I was like, hey, Gertrude, can you come in during Peter's session and just observe for 5 minutes and see if you have any feedback for how I structure my session? So just calling her in so I can ask her perspective on what I'm doing. Not saying necessarily like, teach me how to do this. Can you like tell me what I'm doing wrong? But can you just tell me what you're seeing as I interact with this kid? That has been really helpful because it's very open-ended and it signals to them that I'm going to value your input.
Yes, exactly. I'm valuing your input. On my end, the way it looks for me is, especially if we've got a learner who's got a longer session, we've got 30 minutes with our SLP. I'm stepping back. I'm going to observe and I'm going to listen. I might ask some questions here and there. My approach is I'm not here to step on anybody's toes. I'm here to watch and learn, and I'm here to help support this learner through this process. We have maybe some behavior that arises. I'm here to help support you as the SLP, this learner, my RBT, whoever's in this session. That's my approach. It's not everyone's, but that's my approach. But I like that. Like, can you just observe? Can you see? Because again, if we're circling back to what is valuable, if we're circling back to core yearnings, everybody wants to feel like they belong. Everybody wants to feel like they are competent at something. Everybody wants to feel included. And by starting a session like that and saying, can you observe? Can you just like give me some feedback? What magic.
And I'm looking at the yearnings. I can't wait to read more about this, but like the yearning for competence, right? I'm in a bunch of Facebook groups for different elements of my field just so I can like see what people are talking about. Especially I'm in like Facebook groups for approaches or frameworks that I really disagree with because I want to know what's being talked about. But I'm in one group for like new grads and clinical fellows. And it's not just, there's also like old people like me who are there like giving, advice and recommendations. Every single post I see is, I'm in this setting. I have no idea what I'm doing. Is it always going to be like this? I feel like an imposter. Rachel, every single post I see, there is that yearning for competence. And it might get less. It feels different for me, but still, every day it's like I have this yearning to be like, am I doing the right things? Am I moving towards a better version of myself as an SLP? But if there's this other field that we get communication or like impressions from them that everything we're doing is wrong, that is going to feel threatening to those yearnings, right?
Yes,
So
100%.
where is that middle space where we could even potentially cultivate belonging in this middle, right? There's also kind of, like in-group, out-group psychological stuff, because yearning for belonging, we might pull more closely to our field, right? I'm going to pull more closely to ABA. I'm going to pull more closely to SLP, but then it's just going to keep going with those extremes.
Right. If you ever want more resources about ACT, please let me know. I have tons of resources that, like, one of the things when I left my job at the residential facility, I dove into ACT for myself because, again, that core yearning of competence, that core yearning of belonging. But I was struggling, and especially with that imposter syndrome, especially like, was this the right life path for me? Am I doing things right? Am I doing things okay? But really diving into what my values are, and always coming back to that. Whenever I start to feel like this internal sensation of some sort of struggle, that to me is telling me my values are in misalignment and I need to make a change. So I very much invite anyone in this space to dive into acceptance and commitment therapy, just, to explore what your values are, and to help you struggle a little less, because we're all human and we're all susceptible to that feeling of like, I suck at literally everything. I also feel that on a week to week basis. I'm over my head. I don't know what I'm doing. But those thoughts are not helpful. Anyway, whole
And I
other
think,
side
right,
conversation.
like the last thing I'll say there is like because of those vulnerabilities, because of those thoughts that come up of like, which is like, it's so unrealistic. Like, how are we gonna know everything? How? That just this past week and a half, I've been deep researching like the visual motor deficits or differences in autistic bodies and ADHD bodies. I'm telling like all my families, I'm like, we gotta go look at convergence. We have to go look up, like, we gotta look at this. And I had that tendency, right? The well-worn pathway in my brain of why didn't I know about this sooner? I'm a failure. I failed every hundreds of kids before this. Meanwhile, for these families, I'm like the first person who's brought up eyes to them. So we're all trying to do our best to learn as much as we can. And just for these kids, for these families to move them forward. There is, because I'm noticing the time and yapper to yapper. We need to start wrapping it up. But there was one more when I think about that collaboration point where we can meet in the middle. Because I know you've mentioned an experience where you've talked about, echolalia or GLP, and someone was like, nope. And communicating these ideas in ways that maybe your field can connect to, our field can connect to. There was one, because I learned preparing for this that there are, let's see, are there five different types of mans and three types of tacks? There's a lot, right?
God bless Skinner.
And then, oh, there was another one. What was it? The Autoclitics. Hate
Okay.
that word. Don't want to say it again.
Very
Anyway,
much.
hate it. But
There's
what
a
I
whole subsection of verbal behavior written by Skinner and developed by Skinner. And cool, that's awesome. I love that we have like technical language for each of these things. But do I know each and every single one of those? No.
The
Absolutely not.
one that stood out that I thought this could be a really good bridge was echoic behavior, right? Because that is factually a part of your field, right? And when I think about gestalt processing, that is echoic behavior. And it is just, it's an example though of like point by point correspondence.
Yes.
Is that point by point correspondence of I hear it, I echo it back, and a GLP is going to map that. They map it to that moment. It's in your field. It's just the way we think about it and whether it's seen as valuable or not.
Right.
I feel like that could be a bridge term for people.
Yeah. And truly, like, there's still folks to this day that don't find echolalia valuable. But even just like just seeing an Instagram post, and I was like, huh, well, that's interesting. 'Cause I feel like you and I are very similar in like, let me find out more about that. I want to know more. I want to ask some questions. And seeing that there is functionality there when for everything that I've been taught, there's nothing functional about echolalia. It's a behavior that we need to pathologize and that we need to get rid of because it's a stim. We also need to get rid of those because why? If I think back to the seven dimensions of what make ABA, ABA, we talk about social significance. And if I'm trying to extinguish a behavior that is socially valid for that child, I'm not doing ABA. Sorry.
Interesting.
I saw there was a question that asked, like, what does a BCBA do? Essentially, we are analyzing behavior as it's happening. What is it? What is it trying to communicate? What's that function of it? Surface level function, and help teach potentially different responses that are less effortful than, for example, if a child is communicating through aggression. What are we trying to communicate? What can I teach to replace that aggression that still meets that same end, that still gets them that reinforcer that they're looking for? So maybe I present some sort of like math worksheet in a classroom, and a kid's up out of his seat and he's throwing chairs. Okay, cool. We don't like this math worksheet. What can I teach to give you a way to communicate that so that you can get to that result of like, I need more time. I need a break. I need help. I need whatever this is before we get to throw in the chair.
That term you said, the less effortful, I really like that. I really, really like the way that that's phrased because I think there is, I see people have a visceral reaction to the word functional. And I see where they're coming from. And also, like, everything we do does serve a function. There's something about that word. But the idea of less effortful, I think that's such a gentle, compassionate way of talking about replacement or like creating something more adaptive. Absolutely. I'm noticing the time. I just want to say to everyone who participated today, we had great participation from our audience. Thank you, everyone. I know we didn't get to everything. Please come back for another episode of the Gestalt Get Together. Rachel, I really appreciate it. I definitely would love to have you back to talk about the yearnings,
Oh my
which
gosh,
honestly,
let's.
it's, talking about yearning is such a meme, and like it's so funny. That's what
It's
it's
very
called.
cottagecore.
No, it's like such a millennial meme. But I'd love to have you back for that because the idea, like, it's such a cool area of your field that I think a lot of SLPs who care about GLPs will be like, oh, that I see myself in that. All
And
right.
I think if we think about like ultimately collaborating, we're both humans.
What?
We're both humans and we
No,
have. No, we're
no.
not.
I'm
No.
just AI. Sorry, I'm a bot.
It's very, very convincing.
You. I am a large language model. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Come find us on Instagram. Come say hi, and we'll see you at the next episode of the Gestalt Get Together. Bye.